introducing our first guest today. It's Greg Mitchell. He's the editor of Editor and Publisher. The website is editorandpublisher.org. And he's a man with X-ray eyes. In economic terms, his foresight and dedication are what's called his comparative advantage that he holds over the rest of us, which I guess is why he's the editor of Editor and Publisher for a living. Seems a good fit. The new book is called So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. Welcome back to the show, Greg. How are you doing?
Happy to be here again.
It's very good to have you here, sir. And this is really an incredible book, a catalog, month by month, year by year, of editorials that you wrote for Editor and Publisher, almost all of it critiquing media coverage of the war that George Bush called America's golden moment. And now that we're 5 years later, 4,000 Americans killed, the Nobel Prize-winning economists are saying this thing's going to cost us $5 trillion before it's over, in no small part taking care of the 50,000-something wounded, including all the post-traumatic stress disorder and brain injuries and so forth. Seems like a good time to review how it was that we got here. And the biggest part of the story, almost, really, besides what they were cooking up at the White House and in the Pentagon, was the role that the American media played in transmitting whatever ideas the government wanted us to hold to the minds of the American people. Somewhere in this book you say the press is supposed to be the last line of defense for the people, and instead it turned around and was the defense for the government against us.
Right. Well, that's true. As you mentioned, the book is it sort of surprised need to be able to say at the fifth anniversary that it's really the only book that really looks at the whole history of the war from the run-up to the debate over the surge last fall. It's surprising there were not more books that came out. So I guess this is the only real history out there of the full 5 years. And as you said, it does chronicle month by month, you know, through my own writing. It does have an original, I wrote an introduction for it, a quite lengthy new introduction. Joe Galloway, the famed war reporter, wrote a new foreword, and Bruce Springsteen provided a brief preface as well. So there is a lot of new material as well. But, you know, it's useful to go back and look again at both the run-up to the war and what's happened since. And you kind of see, you know, these are a lot of stories in there that you kind of remember. You you know they happened at some point. They're lodged in your memory somehow. And but when you can read them in really chronological order, you kind of see how things developed. You see how public opinion was shaped. You see how what was being said at different stages of the war, particularly when you look at what pundits, columnists, talking heads on TV have said, how that went on year, month after month, year after year. I know Tom Friedman of the New York Times gets a lot of heat for his every 6 months saying, just give us another 6 months. But, really, that's the majority. That was the majority view of editorial pages and, you know, columnists and so forth. And it is instructive to see that, you know, see that played out over a long period.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the most striking thing about the book is just how prescient you are. You talk a lot about Vietnam in the book, and I guess your views of how seriously government is to be taken when they're trying to get us into a war were formed by that era. But it seems like you were, you know, one out of a thousand in the run-up to the war who could see exactly where this was going. I think it's your interview with Bill Moyers from before the war where you say, this is only the very beginning of the story of America and Iraq in the 21st century.
Right.
We'll be dealing with this for decades to come, you told him.
Right. Well, I wish I was proven wrong, but I think I may have been just about the first person to use the word quagmire to describe what was coming in Iraq. I think I used it about 2 weeks into the war itself, even before Baghdad fell. And I was, and I used it for many months after that, and I was sort of ridiculed and mocked by many people. And what does Vietnam have to do with Iraq? And, you know, it's desert versus jungle, and, you know, the food is different, I guess. It was interesting to note that John Burns, the famous New York Times war correspondent, when he did his fifth anniversary wrap-up last week, actually used in his middle of his piece, he used the expression Iraq quagmire. He didn't use it ironically. He didn't use it as a joke or anything like that. It wasn't in quotes. He just stated it as a fact. And here 5 years ago, I was being ridiculed for using it. So, and of course, the point is that, you know, once we went in, and there were other people like Chris Hedges and Daniel Ellsberg and other people on the left who were making the same argument I was making, but it was the Vietnam connection is really that, you know, once you go in, it's hard to get out. You know, once you've lost a number of soldiers, it's hard to, you know, it's you continually want to justify staying in to make their lives worth it, as they say. So, you know, the title of the book, So Wrong for So Long, you know, is meant to connote this, you know, this 5 year, adventure that we've had there, and I'm afraid I'll have to do a sequel 5 years from now.
Yeah, well, and it's really the 6 years almost, the 5.5, 6 years since they started lulling us into it. And,
right.
And now, let me ask you this. Aren't most of these reporters that we're dealing with here from your generation? It seems like Well, you know, I was born in 76, right? So I would have an excuse if, you know, I had never read a book before or something to think that wars are just great. And when a president says we ought to have a war, then hell yeah, we should. But it seems like people who lived through Vietnam, these are the reporters, it seems like they would know better than me, and they didn't.
Well, I mean, you're right. Most of the, maybe not most of the war reporters in Iraq who went to Iraq, we're not mainly the problem, you know. It was mainly columnists and editors back home, a lot of the talking heads on TV. And you're right, they were certainly old enough to remember or actually have even been in journalism during Vietnam. So, yes, they should have known better. Now, there were some older people like David Halberstam, like Joe Galloway, who I mentioned before, and others. A lot of people who actually have covered previous wars could see the dangers of what was coming, could see that the real, as you mentioned, the real human cost, as evidenced in Iraq by, you know, the phenomenal number of injuries, not the deaths so much, but the traumatic brain damage, you know, and lost limbs and so forth. So the 4,000 number, which we've passed this week, you know, is a little misleading because you have many, many more higher percentage of grievous injuries than in any previous war. So, and of course, you mentioned the financial cost and the trillions, which is also badly covered by the media until the past few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me if this is right. I actually find myself so immersed in the news all the time that sometimes I have trouble figuring out what it is that my neighbors think about what's going on in the world and so forth. And I think my best approximation is that the media in general didn't really begin to even question the White House's point of view on pretty much anything until the Katrina disaster in 2005. Was that pretty much the breaking point, do you think, where they finally decided, hey, wait a minute, this guy George Bush isn't some, you know, St. Gabriel?
Yeah, well, I that's often said. I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, there was growing criticism of Bush. I mean, his approval ratings were already, you know, plunging by then. You know, there was growing criticism. A lot of reporters, it turned out there were no WMD in Iraq, you know, they started being more critical, asking tougher questions and having some more honest reports from the war zone. So that had already set in. There's no doubt that the Katrina episode had a bigger effect on public opinion, I think, in terms of seeing that this guy was handling Iraq like he had Katrina. So I think that was kind of the revelation. But I think it was setting in that that Rumsfeld was a screw up and, you know, Colin Powell had totally misled the country at the United Nations, and Condoleezza Rice really did nothing. Where was she at? So it was starting to set in that the administration as a whole was more incompetent than people had ever let on.
Mm-hmm. Well, Now, maybe it's because I'm young and I don't have as much historical context, but have you ever seen a press corps so entirely devoted to an administration and their party line as what happened in the run-up to the war in the first couple of years of this war?
Well, it's hard to compare because there really was nothing quite like this where you had this drumbeat for war. You had 9/11, which was unique, whatever you think of it, it certainly was a unique action. We went after Afghanistan, which the press was certainly behind. And, that should have been, when you look at the analysis and some people say, well, the press wanted to prove they were patriotic and the press wanted to get behind a war and the press wanted to, strike back at 9/11. Well, that was accomplished in Afghanistan, It was sort of like, okay, we got that out of our system and fine, but, then we went into Iraq. And so I think that the people who say that, that it was understandable, the press coverage, I think that's true in terms of Afghanistan. But once you get another year later and you're talking about Iraq where, we'd never had not attacked us. And I think, one of the other continuing themes in the book, which is, I think illuminating, if a little depressing, is I continually, every, 50 pages or something, talk about a new public opinion poll, which, invariably keep showing that, a majority or close to a majority of Americans, continued to think that Saddam, helped plan 9/11, mm-hmm. and that Iraqi hijackers were among the hijackers. Or that inspectors had found WMD in Iraq during the, before the war.
In fact, wasn't it just last year some of those numbers had gone up?
Yeah, they went up slightly, yeah. Yeah. It's no longer the majority, but, particularly when we went to war, the last polls that were done just before we went to war all showed majority belief in those complete myths. Now, who was to blame? Well, part of it was the media in general doing a poor educational job. Part of it is of course a large number of Americans who get all their news now from talk radio and from Fox News. So the mainstream media didn't maybe have much of a chance with those people, but nevertheless, it's just shocking. I think when history is written, and I guess my book is the first draft of complete history, I guess, when people go back and look at these numbers, I just think it's one of the most shocking things about the whole episode that, we went to war with public support that was based largely on myth.
Yeah, well, and largely, you mean 70%. That's a super-duper majority, I think.
Yeah.
Belief that it was Saddam Hussein was behind that attack. In fact, I remember in 2002 telling the guy that, hey, listen, man, if you listen closely, George Bush has not even said, Condoleezza Rice has not even said that Saddam did it. And
well,
the
yeah,
guy said to me,
they always had a little, in other words, they would kind of say it and then say, well, it's not proven or, we don't really know or whatever. So they
kind of
planted the seed.
Well, they would say, the reason we have to attack Iraq is because of 9/11. ..
Right.
7 second pause, and then they'd say, because we learned the lesson that from now on we have to attack everybody first.
Right. Right.
But this guy's answer to me was that I must be crazy, that of course Iraq did it, or else why would we be invading them?
Yeah, it's a little backwards, I guess. Like, surely we wouldn't be invading a country that didn't attack us.
Of course not.
I think there is, I think another thing the book does is, that this 5-year chronology does is shows people that as long as 3 or 4 years ago, the public opinion polls had already shifted to a majority view that A, the war was a mistake, B, it's not worth it, as the expression would go, it's not worth it continuing, and C, that we should start withdrawing, and even that we should withdraw within 12 months. These became, 40% and then 50%, 60%, 62%, whatever the current figure is, for all those things. So you kind of balance that, if you're going back 3 or 4 years ago, with what the media was saying. The media in their editorials and on TV and so forth was not sort of reflecting. It's almost like where we're Cheney most recently when they, you know, in the recent interviews where they said, well, what about public opinion being against the war? And he said, so what, you know?
Right.
It's kind of where the media is acted. And, you know, it would not have been a profile in courage for the media to take a stand here. In fact, it would have reflected the majority of their viewers or readers.
Right.
And so it's, I mean, sometimes we demand that the media take kind of a courageous step or something that's a little ahead of public opinion. But
well, I noticed that in the book, you chronicle the editorial pages, particularly of the Post, the Times, the Los Angeles Times, USA Today, and it's not till the end of the book where you finally start getting, in I guess early last year, you finally get the first newspaper editorials calling for withdrawal. And up until this time, as you say, the polls have been reflecting, the American people have been feeling that way for a long time, and yet it was considered beyond the pale. They would even write in the papers that, well, no one is seriously talking about a real withdrawal, and
right.
and act like this was the kind of thing that, oh, well, you know, those lefty kooks over at MoveOn.org are talking about it, but nobody else in America is seriously considering leaving, even though a supermajority
right.
wanted out.
Right. Well, it is odd. You know, there was this continual belief that, you know, progress is around the corner. And, you know, I think one of the little noted, really, everyone kind of has read about or knows about the media failures before the war, the WMD, misreporting and so forth. But, you know, second on the list for tragic, you know, mistakes or, that really led to horrible results was, as I show in the book, in the weeks before Bush's surge announcement, you know, if you want to relive that period, remember the Iraq study group came out with their, you know, 10-point plan or whatever it was, mm-hmm. and people said at first, well, this is very reasonable. It calls for, you know, start of negotiations, start of, you know, withdrawal somewhere down the line. It was very modest, moderate. And everyone thought that Bush was going to grab onto that like a lifeboat.
Well, and it was on the heels of the Republicans losing both houses of Congress,
right,
too.
Exactly. And so, and then, of course, it came out, and Bush immediately did hands off and said, well, I'm going to come up with my own plan. And then as that December developed, it was, you know, plain as day that he was going to propose some sort of escalation. And yet, as I chronicle in the book, there wasn't a single editorial a newspaper that came out before the surge and said, hey, you know, hold off, or we got to get into this, or, you know, that there was no, you know, there was very little coverage and no one trying to put a halt to it. And then
yeah,
once
you
he
know,
announced
that's
it,
important. I had forgotten
once he announced
about
it,
that.
Then,
but
then a lot of editorials denounced it, or a lot of columnists said, oh, this may not be a good idea, but it was way too late.
Right. I remember Bush had basically announced at the beginning of December 2006 that I'll get back to you about the
right.
middle of January.
Yeah.
And then the press just said, okay, great. Let's
yeah,
just take
yeah,
Christmas
let us know.
Off. That's the end of that.
Right. So you say, what lessons did they learn? You know, it was sort of like when we went to war, there was this march over several months where the press, even the editor of the Washington Post said, you know, well, we knew he was going to go to war. There's nothing we could do to stop it, so our coverage didn't make much difference. There was a sense of a slow motion going to war. It couldn't be stopped, et cetera. The same thing was true with the surge, even though it took place over a month. But nevertheless, the writing was on the wall. And, you know, again, I wrote a couple columns about it, and I think I might have been the first to call the media surge protectors. And, you know, and it played out exactly the same way. And now here we are a year and, you know, 2 months later. And, you know, we have more troops there than we had 4 years ago. And so now you can debate whether the surge has had some success or some positive results, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, nevertheless, we went from the Iraq study group saying, let's start to pull out, to, you know, a year and 3 months later with more troops there. So in terms of the U.S. public opinion and, of course, American deaths and everything else, it's an incredible tragedy to actually have a reversal. And what all of us said at the time, you may remember when all of us were, again, made fun of for trying to call this an escalation instead of a surge.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's what it turned out. I mean, a surge is supposed to be for a few months. You know, a surge was temporary. A surge was, you know, there were benchmarks, and the surge would be reversed after a few months. And, you know, some of us were saying, no, this is like a Vietnam-style escalation. And, of course, that's exactly what it's turned out to be.
Yeah, all the great results were supposed to have been accomplished by last fall, all the benchmarks and so forth, the September Petraeus report.
It's like a permanent surge. You can't have a surge. I mean, a surge is supposed to come and go. It's not supposed to be a permanent. It's not supposed to be permanent. So,
let's stop for a moment, Greg Mitchell, editor of Editor and Publisher, and give credit where credit is due. The guys at Knight Ridder Newspapers, which has since been bought by McClatchy Newspapers, particularly Wolcott, Strobel, Landay, Joe Galloway, who you've mentioned, Lassiter, and recently Nancy Youssef. These are actually real reporters. I like reading McClatchy. I know that. Well, just last week, for example, when Bush said that the Iranians had declared that they wanted to use nukes to kill a bunch of people or something, Jonathan S. Landay went and explained how, no, that's just not true, and his article was better than any of the others that were written along the same lines that day.
Well, I think they have been models from the beginning. You know, because they don't, you know, they're not small, but they're smaller compared to the Times and the Post, that they went to alternative sources. They have other sources. They can think on themselves. They're not stuck inside the Beltway mentality. They look at sources below the top officials who leak things and, you know, self-serving kind of statements and so forth. So, but even since the war started, they start off from a position of let's look at look at the facts, look at the truth, look at get away from the spin zone. And so a lot of their stories, they're very refreshing because you read them and you see that they don't, rather than most mainstream stories, which start from the spin, which start from the official statements, which start with a tremendous respect for whatever the Pentagon or White House line is, and then they may chip away at that, sometimes very well, but they, you know, you have this giant monument and then you chip away at it, where with the McClatchy folks, they seem to start with, okay, well, it's a level playing field. So these people say this, these people say that, here's some facts over here, and now we're going to look at the whole level playing field and, you know, try to find out what's the truth. It really is a different way of going at it.
Well, it's just kind of funny to hear you describe it like that. I mean, this is ought to be journalism 101, even if you take journalism in high school or something. That's how it's supposed to be, and this is the shining example as compared to the rest of them.
Well, I say in the book, I think I mentioned my journalism school days, and I say that about the first rule you're taught is to be skeptical, not necessarily critical, not necessarily negative, but skeptical. And so, whether you're talking to the local highway department chairman, or you're talking to the Secretary of Defense, it should be the same rule. If someone has a dog in the fight, or someone is in a position where they're trying to justify something or they want to get something, you say, okay, well, that's an interesting that they're saying that. I'll take that down. But, you know, God, they're biased. Or they're of course they want us to, believe this. And now I'll go out and find out what's really going on. And, too often it's the official line becomes the only line. And so that's why I keep using the word skeptical, because skeptical is the key word, not necessarily critical.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about censorship in the newsroom, self-censorship on the part of reporters, particularly the ones reporting from Iraq, the embedded soldiers, embedded reporters, sorry, slip of the tongue there, toward the early days of the war. And particularly, Greg, if you can touch on the pictures and how we just don't see pictures of the consequences of this war. I mean, when I think of the war in Iraq, all I can picture is the nice neighborhood and the green grass out my window. I don't even know what the war in Iraq looks like, Greg.
Right. Well, again, that's a continuing theme in the book, raised early on. We had a lot of coverage of the embedded program, pros and cons, rules, and whether the reporters were too rah-rah because of traveling with the soldiers and being protected by the soldiers and so forth. So that's kind of one continuing theme. And then another continuing theme is the images, starting with the Pentagon's ban on showing the returning coffins from Iraq, which went on and year after year.
The Dover test.
Yeah. But it's more than that. As you suggest, it became, the failure of the mainstream media to show images of, graphic images of Americans who were injured or killed in Iraq. There's a couple reasons for it. One is that the Pentagon rules prevent showing anything like that until all family members have been notified. That can take 3 or 4 days, and by that time, the photos are no longer news, and so they get discarded because they're not news. But the media, at the same time, could always use those photos later. They make choices all the time on what to show, and they will claim there's matters of taste and matters of not wanting to show. There are ways to show things, graphic things, without showing bodies and blood. But I would disagree, and I think that as I show in the book, as it goes along, there's more and more criticism of the failure to give Americans the true sense of the war. They may have some sense of the war, but without seeing some of these images, and of course they are available online if people want to look for them and so forth, but in terms of 90% of the public has not really seen much on TV or and in newspapers of a really graphic nature where they'd step back and say, geez, this really is, blood and guts.
Well,
and,
part of this is the American
what it
people,
is. That's
too.
That's what war is. War is not just someone giving a press briefing.
Right. Yeah, exactly, with a $100,000 Hollywood set behind them. But the thing is, as you point out in the book, all these editors, their excuse over and over again, and it's a somewhat plausible one, is that if they ever show a picture of a dead body anywhere in their newspaper, they get all these phone calls from people right. calling them America-hating traitors.
Right. Yeah, and some of them have stuck to their guns, and other times they have apologies, or they say, well, we won't do that again, and so forth. So, I can understand the feelings of some people seeing these images. But, the greater good or the greater duty is to show anything, in its true dimensions. And certainly a war, that we've lost so many people, but also the cost to all of us without, I think we should focus on the human cost. But when you look at the financial cost and how all of us are going to be paying, I guess you're younger, you'll be paying for it a lot longer than I will. But,
thanks.
I have a 20-year-old son, and I have a daughter, and so forth. So, we're all going to be paying for children and grandchildren for the rest of the century for this war. So, I think the media has a responsibility to show everyone what's going on.
Remember when they were saying that the war was going to be revenue neutral?
Yeah, we were going to pay for it with the oil revenue and so on and so forth. So, I don't know what happened to that plan, but I guess the pipelines got blown up, so that was a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, well, if anything, that ought to just drive the cost up more, which ought to mean they can finance their own reconstruction even better, right?
Well, something like that. I don't know. I don't know where the money, I guess the money left the country in, brown paper sacks.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Tom Friedman in the term of the Friedman Unit, which is how left-wing bloggers make fun of Tom Friedman and his many, many statements, as you catalog in the book, of we're right around the corner, the next 6 months are going
right.
to be crucial and so forth. And so in that sense, he has been targeted. And yet, in my mind, Tom Friedman is the perfect example of the kind of media commentator who completely gets away with it. Here's a guy who has the blood of hundreds of thousands of people on his hands, and yet somehow, still to this day, here's a guy we ought to listen to. Here's a guy who's real serious in his analysis of foreign policy. Here's a guy that's gotten everything wrong this whole time. Why is he still on anybody's editorial page anywhere?
Well, there's a lot of others in that position. I hate to single out poor Tom, but, it certainly...
Well, I pick on him, Greg, because he's not a neocon, because he's a neoliberal.
Right. Well, I'm not sure what he is, to tell you the truth. But as I state in the book, not just him, but many others, Bill Kristol being a leading example, someone who can be wrong about everything and yet be on TV more than ever, run a magazine and then end up getting a column in the New York Times. Now, I'm not opposed to the New York Times having diversity, but, to pick someone who has been wrong about everything forever you know, it's really a disservice to readers. You know, get someone who has some credibility and is at least occasionally right, if you want to give a different viewpoint. But, you know, almost all of the people who were so wrong about the war have, if anything, flourished. And, you know, so that's, you know, there's no backlash, I guess you might say.
Yeah, see, that's really the puzzling part, too, because you would think that there would have to be some kind of major house cleaning at CNN and DC, even if not Fox.
Well, what troubles me is, as we've seen just in the last week or two, in the tremendous amount of coverage about the war, the fifth anniversary of the war, and hundreds of stories or thousands of stories and hundreds of TV hours and so on and so forth. And in all that time, fingers were pointed, analysis of everyone's shortcomings, this went wrong, and so on and so forth. But the media didn't do hardly any reassessment of the media. There was, when you think about it, maybe it hasn't occurred to you that much, but anyone listening, just think and say, well, wait a minute, did I see much, or did I see anything, or, I didn't see anything about the media's performance in all this. And, I'm afraid it reflects, maybe it's shame or guilt or whatever, but I think maybe they want people to forget about it. And when you talk about this lack of backlash to people who are wrong, it's almost as if the media feel that it's not that big, that this war is not that big a deal. It's almost like, it's a bad thing, or it's something that's not good, and bad episode and so forth. But, not all that bad, because otherwise you would look at it and say, this is like the greatest tragedy this country has been through for 40 years at least, and it was preventable, and it was criminal, and it's still going on, and yet it's just not worth reassessing the media's own role in it. And that's and no one pays the price.
Yeah, well, they'd all just have to resign in mass, I guess, right?
Not,
I mean, I'm just
deal.
Picturing in my head Chris Matthews and the guys at MSNBC as you're talking, Joe Scarborough, the former congressman. These guys would all have to just resign in disgrace all at once. They're just as guilty as anybody else.
Well,
as the people they're covering.
Well, like I said, it's almost as if it's not that big a deal. They got you can say, well, we got this one wrong. But, it's an enormous one to get wrong. It's like a doctor who, misdiagnoses something and, a whole town is wiped out by some plague. And, well, I got that one wrong.
Yeah, they all shrug.
I got that one wrong.
Yeah, well, in fact, in the book where you talk about the deaths, the first city on your list that you compare the number of deaths to is my hometown of Austin, Texas. Imagine the population of Austin, Texas being wiped out over lies, over nothing.
Well, that's what you're referring to is the, some studies that show that hundreds of thousands of, it's generally the official line is that only tens of thousands of Iraqis have died, but a lot of studies suggest that it's hundreds of thousands. So it's, when you compare that number to certain, like, cities, medium size or, good size cities being completely wiped out, that's where, you think about that. And then, of course, you think about another 2 million that have fled the country. So, even if the surge, I don't want to get into a debate on the surge, but even if the surge has been, has been somewhat successful in curbing violence and so forth, you still have to imagine that the country has been, emptied out of people and already massive killing, sectarian slaughter, and so forth. So,
and I don't think anybody's disputing the refugee numbers there. The 2 million something refugees who've had to flee the country. I mean, that's four Austins worth of people who've had to flee. And that's incredible when you put it in those terms. When it's just 2.5 million people, that's just a number. But when you think of the entire population of Austin having to flee to Houston or something, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Now, something else, and if I understand this story right, you deserve the lion's share of the credit for this. The government at the beginning of the war did not want to classify any non-combat deaths in Iraq as part of the casualty count. And you basically called them out on it and forced them to revise that policy. Is that right?
Well, I'd like to think that we did it. At the time, I thought it was mainly our responsibility. I don't know for sure, but if you go back, now this is going back almost 5 years ago, when there weren't as many casualties, but the way they were being reported in the paper, they were separating out the, you know, the real, you know, death in combat with a, you know, a bullet versus all the many other casualties, which were coming from, you know, people rushing to a war zone, and you know, the Humvee went in the ditch, or people who died from other accidents and the friendly fire, and so on and so forth. And they were trying to keep the numbers down by just releasing the ones that were, strictly speaking, heavy combat. And so we noted that and plugged away at it. And after a little while, the papers, their numbers changed and sort of continued to this day.
I'm talking with Greg Mitchell. He's the editor of Editor and Publisher. The website is editorandpublisher.org. The new book
is .com, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it .com?
Yep.
Oh, my mistake. I'll fix that right here in my notes. The book is So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. And something else that you've been focused on over all these years, and this is, I think, the subject that I first interviewed you about, if I remember right, is suicides.
Right.
Among the soldiers, and how little attention that gets from the media and from the government.
Yeah, and it's continuing. I write about it almost once a week at our website and in blog postings. It continues to this day. In fact, I just put up a posting at the Huffington Post on a story about a fellow I'm calling, you know, Iraqi death or U.S. death 4001. It's a guy who was had severe head injury, had facial surgery from an IED, came back to the U.S., and a few months later, he was found dead in his barracks, and they can't figure out exactly why he died. May have been suicide or may not have been, and they haven't classified it. And so he's not considered in the 4,000 because they can't prove anything one way or another. So his mother is just beside herself, saying, "How can you not? This guy was, I mean, I've used this expression myself, killed by Iraq." And it's like anyone who has served there, who then is so damaged by it, physically or mentally, that they end up dying, you know, in short time later, you know, should be considered dead, killed by Iraq, and should be considered, you know, fatalities just like any other.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, if you would, the story of Alyssa Peterson.
Well, this was, I came across this, in a small radio station, someone, who lived near her. I believe the fellow's name was Kevin Elston, who, lived, near Alyssa Peterson's hometown of Flagstaff, Arizona. And he, I guess, had been interested in this case and kept at it and got some Freedom of Information Act papers. And, a couple years ago or a year ago, came out with the first information that, a young woman named Alyssa Peterson, who was I believe a sergeant and was a sort of interpreter, knew Arabic, and so she was assigned as a sort of interpreter in interrogations in Iraq. And this was early in the war when they were particularly rough sessions. And she was sort of a deeply religious young woman and so forth, and she was so appalled by the interrogation techniques, you know, maybe it was absolute torture or just borderline torture, but she was so appalled that, you know, just a few weeks after being, you know, begging to be taken off that detail, she shot herself to death. And, you know, it seemed pretty clear that her experience and her disillusionment, was a main cause for that. So I wrote about it, and it got picked up many places. Actually, I wrote about it. I sort of returned to it a couple weeks ago, and again, it got a lot of attention. It's just such a sad and revealing story. It seems to really hit people.
Well, and the military, I don't know if they outright lied about it, but they certainly did not tell the whole truth to the public,
right,
or to the,
yeah,
the girl's
family.
Yeah,
the didn't know about it. Yeah, until, I mean, it took a radio journalist to get these papers which revealed the true cause and details of her death. Her family didn't even know about it, they said. So this is often the case with suicides, they kind of go into limbo. They go into cosmic investigation that goes on for years, and the press, fortunately the local press sometimes gets the true story. A family member will say something, maybe someone's being, it's in the local paper, and then someone talks to a family member and they say, oh yeah, they say he shot himself. And so that fact will come out, which we never would have gotten otherwise.
In the book, you make quite a few references to Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and their satire news coverage on the Comedy Channel. How important do you think those two shows have been to coverage of the war, Greg?
Well, you can probably think back to yourself 5 years ago. They were not seen as so, liberal. I mean, I think Jon Stewart has kind of come out of the closet a bit. And I think, night after night, kind of making fun of the president and the pronouncements on the war, whether they call it Mesopotamia.
Right.
Certainly has a big effect on people because there are more and more people who get much of their news from those two shows, which, for better or worse, we could debate that too, I suppose. But, since so many people do get a lot of their attitudes from those shows, certainly that has an effect. Now, Stephen Colbert has also had both of the shows, as you know, make fun of the media as much as the president. And the media itself is mocked regularly. So I think that's contributed to the whole mood as well. Colbert and his famous White House correspondence dinner routines, people remember it as making fun of the president. But he spent just as much time, or nearly as much time, making fun of the media. And they didn't particularly like it. So they either ignored what his routine, or when they reviewed it, they said, oh, he wasn't that funny.
Right, I actually just watched that footage again about a week or two ago, I guess, and it really is amazing, kind of this giant audience of media people all sitting on their hands. Justice Scalia at least laughed at the jokes directed at him.
Yeah.
The rest of these people, they didn't think it was very funny at all.
The media response was so defensive, and there the evidence was on. Maybe in the old days, first of all, the old days, no one would have known about this. The whole routine. But now with YouTube and everything, people can judge for themselves, So people say, well, the media said he wasn't funny and blah, blah, blah. Well, I watched it on YouTube. I thought he was hysterical, So again, it gives the media a black eye because it looks like, well, they're telling me something that's not true. So what else aren't they telling me?
Right. All right, everybody. That's Greg Mitchell. He's the editor of Editor and Publisher. The website is editorandpublisher.com. The new book is So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. And I know that there's an article that you wrote in the Viewpoint section today on antiwar.com, and another one in the Frontline News section as well. I've been writing all over the place lately, so I urge everybody to Google your name and try to find out what they can, and I want to thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's always a pleasure, and, it's obviously an important issue that I'm afraid I'm going to be back here 5 years from now giving you the same type of interview.
Well, I'm afraid that that's probably true, although I'll at least take a little comfort in knowing what an example you serve to the rest of them in the meantime.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.